by eligibility. Tired of replacing expensive inkjet printer cartridges? Maybe it's time you replaced the printer you put them in instead. Switch to a Kodak printer and stop overpaying for ink. With other inkjet printers, the way to save money on ink is to print less. But Kodak printers only use fairly priced ink. Get a new Kodak printer this weekend at Best Buy and join the thousands who've stopped overpaying for ink.
Find out how. Electric of Sandy reminds listeners, last year over 50,000 children were reported missing. Parents, keep recent fingerprints, photographs, and dental records. They are all important items in recovering a missing child. If you have any information that could lead to the recovery of a child, call the local authorities immediately. This reminder from John's Electric, located at 965 East, 9400 South in Sandy. For more information, call 801-255-4586. That's 801-255-4586.
Hi.
This is Abundance. I am your host, Dane Allred. Today we'll look at bridges, number 119 from my list of 1,001 thanks. Week on Abundance, we celebrate one of the 1,001 things I'm thankful for from my list of 1,001 thanks. This week, bridges, number 119 is our topic. Today's topics from Dane Allred's partly colored dream code include Dream the Dream, Cowed, and from Literature Out Loud, I'll be reading Ambrose Bierce's An Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge in the poem composed upon Westminster Bridge by William Wordsworth. Dane Allred's partly colored dream coat. Dream the dream. At one time, someone stood looking across a crevasse. They could see the lush growth on the other side, but there was no way to get there. A human mind doesn't take a challenge lightly, and at some time long ago, some ingenious person decided to span the gap, build a bridge, and connect to that unknown. Bridges are one way we can explore that unknown territory, and when we build them, we're looking forward to see what can happen when here meets there. The first bridge was probably just a tree across a river, but that image has stayed with us, and every time we wanted to get from here to there, we build bridges. When we want to unite land masses, we build a bridge. When we want to unite people, we also need to build a bridge. There are some people in our past who have been really good at building bridges between cultures, spanning the differences between people with some kind of inspiration that will bind them together. Think about Martin Luther King Jr. The image we associate most with his historic efforts at civil rights is his I Have a Dream speech. Think about this speech and try to think of the visual bridge he created, which Americans finally united to end separate but equal. Can you see that image in your mind, which ended decades of Jim Crow laws and brought civil rights reforms to the United States? Call me crazy, but I think the bridge is the simple phrase, one day, right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. Were you thinking of the same image? There are many, many things said in that speech which evoke images ranging from Bible passages to a spirited rendition of My Country, Tis of Thee. Why would I think only of the little children hand in hand? Maybe you thought of something else, but that bridge for me is one of the reasons I think of this speech as a great bridge. Gandhi was another great bridge builder, also freeing the nation of India with nonviolent protest. George Washington built the bridge between revolution and democracy. Abraham Lincoln reunified a country divided with the bridge of his resolve. Mother Teresa spent her life bridging the gap to the poor with her tireless efforts. Where there's a problem, there can be a bridge builder. I have many, many bridges in my life. One bridge connects a Southern Baptist heritage with a Mormon conversion. Another bridge connects blue-collar generations with the first college education and white-collar work. Another bridge connects artistic endeavor and practicality. You probably have all kinds of bridges in your life, too. Is there a bridge we need to build together? The gap between the rich and the poor has never been larger, but what is the bridge that brings people out of crushing poverty? The world has plenty, but the distribution of that plenty is unequal. What is the bridge that gives to those who have nothing? Our world of bounty is nothing new to us, but how can we help everyone enjoy the plenty that we enjoy? There are those who think of this as a world of scarcity with only enough for some. I believe in the abundance which is limitless and depends only on our ingenuity to bring about the changes which today are only dreams. But remember, bridges begin with dreams. Limitless energy? Maybe that's your job. Assuring that no one goes to bed hungry? Maybe you will be the dreamer. Educational opportunities for everyone who wants them? That might be right up your alley. Finding cures for disease? Maybe you're the one who will dream the solution first. I remember when I was very young, looking at the world around me, not knowing there was any other kind of life than what I knew. Only as I got older did I realize there were people who were richer and poorer than me, more advantage and less advantage than I was, and those who could never imagine the incredible life I've been able to live. Join me on this wonderful journey as we find a way to build a bridge to the future we can all imagine as a better place for all of us, a place where the children of all the world can walk hand in hand into a place we now only dream of. It was 100 years from the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation to civil rights legislation. What will you and I dream that will be the new bridge to what we can be tomorrow? This is Abundance. Today we're discussing bridges, number 119 from my list of 1,001 thanks. Everything you hear on Abundance is available 24/7 at danaallred.podbean.com. Dane Allred's partly colored dream coat. Cowed. Bridges can sometimes betray us. Just when we think all is safe and it's time to cross, you end up stuck and walking down a canyon in the dark and getting scared out of your wits. I live in a strange place which is a citadel of civilization, yet an hour east or south and you're in the middle of the Old West, complete with dirt trails, cow fences, bridges made of pine poles and long planks. When I used to cut trees in the mountains for fence poles and posts, my dad arranged for me to cut a stand of trees up a long canyon and then up a long dirt road. I love using a chainsaw, cutting and trimming trees, the smell of fresh cut wood, especially pine. I would cut 30 or 40 trees, load them on the truck, and call it a day's work. It was good for me, and I really enjoyed it. But in case I got stuck, Dad had told me just to walk down the dirt road and wait on the main road, and he would come pick me up if I didn't show up at night. Luckily, I only had to walk out once, but once was enough. I got stuck another time in the same canyon, but a sheep herder saved me, but that's another story. I would drive an hour on the main road, then the dirt road was another 45 minutes, going about 20 or 30 miles an hour. So it was probably 5 or 10 miles from the main road to the wooden bridge I needed to cross to get to the trees I was supposed to cut. At the small bridge, again made of some pine poles and a couple of long pieces of 2x6 or 2x8 planks, it wasn't an engineering marvel, but it got you from one side to the other. Sometimes it was a little wet and slick if the water was high, but I crossed it so many times I didn't even worry about it anymore. The back end of the truck slid off to one side while the front wheels were still on the improvised bridge. I was stumped. I tried to pry the back wheels back up onto the bridge, but it was no use. Let's just say the work I did that day was to unsuccessfully get the back of the truck onto the bridge. So as the sun began to set, I decided it might be time to start walking down the dirt road to wait for Dad. It was incredibly dark, and there was no moon. If you've never been miles and miles away from the city to see the incredible stars, you really need to do it someday. It is an amazing sight, and there seems to be 10 times as many stars as you've ever seen before. The dirt road was just a little lighter than the sagebrush next to it. I couldn't even see if there were rocks or ruts to avoid, so I stumbled a few times. I must have been making quite a racket. Remember, I've already told you there were cow fences, and what that means is every so often there would be a gate to close or there would be a cow grating. These are metal bridges that cows don't cross, so they stay where they're supposed to. This also drew other animals to the mountain, including bears, wolves, coyotes. As I turned a corner and stumbled a bit, something off the side of the road jumped up and crashed through the sagebrush. For all I knew, it was crashing toward me, so I ran as fast as I could down the dirt road in the pitch black in the opposite direction. After a few moments, I realized nothing was chasing me, so as I slowed up to listen, I could hear the calf I had surprised on the road still running the other way. Needless to say, I had plenty of energy left to make it to the bottom of the canyon. I sat for a while. Then my dad pulled up in his truck. I don't think I told him about how his son had been terrified of a cow in the middle of a dark canyon. We went up the next day and pulled my truck off the bridge. Then I drove across it and went to work while Dad went back to the farm. What's the moral to the story? Well, if there is one, I guess it would be not to trust every bridge you see. Maybe the moral is to be careful even when you have crossed the same bridge many times before. Maybe the real moral is not to be afraid of that cow in the dark. This is Abundance, a program of 1001 Thanks. I'm your host, Dane Allred, and I believe you can change your life and the world by celebrating the joy, the happiness, and the positive parts of this wonderful journey we call life. I am extremely thankful for the opportunity I've been given to host Abundance. We're trying to get that positive boost we all need as we prepare to face a new week. You can hear Abundance this same time each Sunday night from 7 to 8 p.m. I love being positive, seeing the good and even the bad things that happened to all of us. in just a moment. Literature Out Loud, Ambrose Bierce's An Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge, and the poem composed upon Westminster Bridge by William Wordsworth. It's 20 minutes past the hour. On Abundance, we search for a way to be more positive in an ever-increasingly negative world. Where others attack, we seek to be thankful for this day and for all the bounty of this earth. I am the incurable optimist, and we are here today to celebrate all the wonderful people and opportunities we enjoy in today's world. I'm so serious about being positive, I write a plus underneath my name, and my blood type is even B positive. I've taken time to write a list of 1,001 things I'm thankful for, and I call it my list of 1,001 thanks. Every week we examine one of the 1,001 ideas to help promote a more positive experience for you and for those around you. Every week on Abundance, we celebrate Literature Out Loud. As a favor to one of the teachers who's requested this particular story, this is for you, Ross. Composed upon Westminster Bridge by William Wordsworth. Earth has not anything to show more fair. Dull would he be of soul who could pass by a sight so touching in its majesty. This city now doth like a garment wear the beauty of the morning. Silent, bare, ships, towers, domes, theaters, and temples lie open unto the fields and to the sky, all bright and glittering in the smokeless air. Never did the sun more beautifully steep in his first splendor, valley, rock, or hill. Never saw I, never felt a calm so deep. The river glideth at his own sweet will. Dear God, the very houses seem asleep. And all that mighty heart is lying still. An Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge by Ambrose Bierce. One. A man stood upon a railroad bridge in northern Alabama, looking down into the swift water 20 feet below. The man's hands were behind his back, the wrists bound with a cord. A rope closely encircled his neck. It was attached to a stout cross timber above his head, and the slack fell to the level of his knees. Some loose boards laid upon the ties supporting the rails of the railway supplied a footing for him and his executioners, two private soldiers of the Federal Army, directed by a sergeant who in civil life may have been a deputy sheriff. At a short remove upon the same temporary platform was an officer in the uniform of his rank, armed. He was a captain. A sentinel at each end of the bridge stood with his rifle in the position known as support, that is to say, vertical, in front of the left shoulder, the hammer resting on the forearm thrown straight across the chest, a formal and unnatural position enforcing an erect carriage of the body. It did not appear to be the duty of these two men to know what was occurring at the center of the bridge. They merely blockaded the two ends of the foot planking that traversed it. Beyond one of the sentinels, nobody was in sight. The railroad ran straight away into a forest for 100 yards, then curving, was lost to view. Doubtless there was an outpost farther along. The outer bank of the stream was open ground, a gentle slope topped with a stockade of vertical tree trunks, looped holes for rifles, with a single embrasure through which protruded the muzzle of a brass cannon commanding the bridge. Midway up the slope between the bridge and the fort were the spectators, a single company of infantry in line at parade rest, the butts of their rifle on the ground, the barrels inclined slightly backward against the right shoulder, the hands crossed upon the stock. A lieutenant stood at the right of the line, the point of his sword upon the ground, his left hand resting upon his right. Excepting the group of four at the center of the bridge, not a man moved. The company faced the bridge, staring stonily, motionless. The sentinels, facing the banks of the stream, might have been statues to adorn the bridge. The captain stood with folded arms, silent, observing the work of his subordinates, but making no sign. Death is a dignitary who, when he comes announced, is to be received with formal manifestations of respect, even by those most familiar with him. In the code of military etiquette, silence and fixity are forms of deference. The man who was engaged in being hanged was apparently about 35 years of age. He was a civilian, if one might judge from his habit, which was that of a planter. His features were good, a straight nose, firm mouth, broad forehead, from which his long dark hair was combed straight back, falling behind his ears to the collars of his well-fitting frock coat. He wore a mustache and a pointed beard, but no whiskers. His eyes were large and dark gray, and had a kindly expression which one would have hardly expected in one whose neck was in the hemp. Evidently, this was no vulgar assassin. The liberal military code makes provision for hanging many kinds of persons, and gentlemen are not excluded. The preparations being complete, the two private soldiers stepped aside and each drew away the plank upon which he had been standing. The sergeant turned to the captain, saluted, and placed himself immediately behind that officer, who in turn moved apart one pace. These movements left the condemned man and the sergeant standing on the two ends of the same plank which spanned three of the cross ties of the bridge. The end upon which the civilian stood almost, but not quite, reached a fourth. This plank had been held in place by the weight of the captain. It was now held by that of the sergeant. At a signal from the former, the latter would step aside, the plank would tilt, and the condemned man go down between two ties. The arrangement commended itself to his judgment as simple and effective. His face had not been covered, nor his eyes bandaged. He looked a moment at his unsteadfast footing, then let his gaze wander to the swirling water of the stream racing madly beneath his feet. A piece of dancing driftwood caught his attention, and his eyes followed it down the current. How slowly it appeared to move. What a sluggish stream. He closed his eyes in order to fix his last thoughts upon his wife and children. The water, touched to gold by the early sun, the brooding mists under the bank at some distance down the stream, the fort, the soldiers, the piece of drift, all had distracted him. And now he became conscious of a new disturbance. Striking through the thought of his dear ones was sound which he could neither ignore nor understand, a sharp, distinct metallic percussion like the stroke of a blacksmith's hammer upon the anvil. It had the same ringing quality. He wondered what it was, and whether immeasurably distant or nearby, it seemed both. Its recurrence was regular, but as slow as the tolling of a death knell. He awaited each new stroke with impatience and, he knew not why, apprehension. The intervals of silence grew progressively longer. The delays became maddening. With their great infrequency, the sounds increased in strength and sharpness. They hurt his ear like the thrust of a knife. He feared he would shriek. What he heard was the ticking of his watch. He unclosed his eyes and saw again the water below him. If I could free my hands, he thought, I might throw off the noose and spring into the stream. By diving, I could evade the bullets and, swimming vigorously, reach the bank, take to the woods, and get away home. My home, thank God, is as yet outside their lines. My wife and little ones are still beyond the invaders' farthest advance. As these thoughts, which have here to be set down in words, were flashed into the doomed man's brain rather than evolved from it, the captain nodded to the sergeant. The sergeant stepped aside. 2. Peyton Farquhar was a well-to-do planter of an old and highly respected Alabama family. Being a slave owner, and like other slave owners, a politician, he was naturally an original secessionist and ardently devoted to the Southern cause. Circumstances of an imperious nature, which it is unnecessary to relate here, had prevented him from taking service with that gallant army which had fought the disastrous campaigns, ending with the fall of Corinth, and he chafed under the inglorious restraint, longing for the release of his energies, the larger life of the soldier, the opportunity for distinction. That opportunity, he felt, would come, as it comes to all in wartime. Meanwhile, he did what he could. No service was too humble for him to perform in the aid of the South, no adventure too perilous for him to undertake if consistent with the character of a civilian who was at heart a soldier, and who in good faith and without too much qualification assented to at least a part of the frankly villainous dictum that all is fair in love and war. One evening, while Farquhar and his young wife were sitting on a rustic bench near the entrance to his grounds, a gray-clad soldier rode up to the gate and asked for a drink of water. Mrs. Farquhar was only too happy to serve him with her own white hands. While she was fetching the water, her husband approached the dusty horseman and inquired eagerly for news from the front.
"The Yanks are repairing the railroads," said the man, "and are getting ready for another advance. They have reached Owl Creek Bridge, put it in order, built a stockade on the north bank. The commandant has issued an order, which is posted everywhere, declaring that any civilian caught interfering with the railroad, its bridges, tunnels, or trains, will be summarily hanged. I saw the order."
"How far is it to the Owl Creek Bridge?" Farquhar asked.
About 30 miles.
"Is there no force on this side of the creek?"
Only a picket post half a mile out on the railroad and a single sentinel at this end of the bridge."
"Suppose a man, a civilian and student of hanging, should elude the picket post and perhaps get the better of the sentinel," said Farquhar, smiling. "What could he accomplish?" The soldier reflected.
"I was there a month ago," he replied. "I observed that the flood of last winter had lodged a great quantity of driftwood against the wooden pier at this end of the bridge. It's now dry and would burn like tinder."
The lady had now brought the water, which the soldier drank. He thanked her ceremoniously, bowed to her husband, and rode away. An hour later, after nightfall, he repassed the plantation, going northward in the direction from which he had come. He was a Federal scout. 3. As Peyton Farquhar fell straight downward through the bridge, he lost consciousness and was as one already dead. From this state, he was awakened, ages later, it seemed to him, by the pain of a sharp pressure upon his throat, followed by a sense of suffocation. Keen, poignant agonies seemed to shoot from his neck downward through every fiber of his body and limbs. These pains appeared to flash along well-defined lines of ramification and beat with an inconceivably rapid periodicity. They seemed like streams of pulsating fire, heating him to an intolerable temperature. As to his head, he was conscious of nothing but a feeling of fullness, of congestion. These sensations were unaccompanied by thought. The intellectual part of his nature was already effaced. He had power only to feel, and feeling was torment. He was conscious of motion, encompassed in a luminous cloud of which he was now merely the fiery heart. Without material substance, he swung through unthinkable arcs of oscillation like a vast pendulum. Then, all at once, with terrible suddenness, the light about him shot upward with the noise of a loud splash. A frightful roaring was in his ears, and all was cold and dark. The power of thought was restored. He knew that the rope had broken, and he had fallen into the stream. There was no additional strangulation. The noose about his neck was already suffocating him and kept water from his lungs. To die of hanging at the bottom of the river, the idea seemed to him ludicrous. He opened his eyes in the darkness and saw above him a gleam of light, but how distant! How inaccessible! He was still sinking, for the light became fainter and fainter until it was a mere glimmer. Then it began to grow and brighten, and he knew that he was rising toward the surface, knew it with reluctance, for he was now very comfortable. To be hanged and drowned, he thought, that is not so bad, but
I do not wish to be shot. No, I will not be shot. That is not fair. He was not conscious of an effort, but a sharp pain at his wrist apprised him that he was trying to free his hands. He gave the struggle his attention, as an idler might observe the feat of a juggler without interest in the outcome. What splendid effort! What magnificent! What superhuman strength! Now that was a fine endeavor! Bravo! The cord fell away. His arms parted and floated upward. The hands dimly seen on each side of the growing light, he watched them with new interest as first one, then the other pounced upon the noose at his neck. They tore it away and thrust it fiercely aside, its undulations resembling those of a water snake. Put it back! Put it back, he thought. He thought he shouted these words to his hands, for the undoing of the noose had been succeeded by the direst pain that he had yet experienced. His neck ached horribly, his brain was on fire, his heart, which had been fluttering faintly, gave a great leap, trying to force itself out at his mouth. His whole body was racked and wrenched with an insupportable anguish, but his disobedient hands gave no heed to the command. They beat the water vigorously with quick downward strokes, forcing him to the surface. He felt his head emerge. His eyes were blinded by the sunlight. His chest expanded convulsively, and with a supreme and crowning agony, his lungs engulfed a great draft of air, which instantly he expelled in a shriek. He was now in full possession of his physical senses. They were, indeed, preternaturally keen and alert. Something in the awful disturbance of his organic system had so exalted and refined them that they made record of things never before perceived. He felt the ripples upon his face and heard their separate sounds as they struck. He looked at the forest on the bank of the stream, saw the individual trees, the leaves, and the veining of each leaf. He saw the very insects upon them, the locusts, the brilliant-bodied flies, the gray spiders stretching their webs from twig to twig. He noted the prismatic colors in all the dewdrops upon a million blades of grass, the humming of the gnats that danced above the eddies of the stream, the beating of the dragonfly's wings, the strokes of the water spider's legs, like oars which had lifted their boat. All these made audible music. A fish slid along beneath his eyes, and he heard the rush of its body parting the water. He had come to the surface facing down the stream. In a moment, the visible world seemed to wheel slowly round, himself the pivotal point, and he saw the bridge, the fort, the soldiers upon the bridge, the captain, the sergeant, the two privates, his executioners. They were in silhouette against the blue sky. They shouted and gesticulated, pointing at him. The captain had drawn his pistol but did not fire. The others were unarmed. Their movements were grotesque and horrible, their forms gigantic. Suddenly he heard a sharp report, and something struck in the water smartly within a few inches of his head, spattering his face with spray. He heard a second report and saw one of the sentinels with his rifle at his shoulder, a light cloud of blue smoke rising from the muzzle. The man in the water saw the eyes of the man on the bridge gazing into his own through the sights of the rifle. He observed that it was a gray eye, and remembered having read that gray eyes were keenest, and that all famous marksmen had them. Nevertheless, this one had missed. A counter-swirl had caught Farquhar and turned him half round. He was again looking at the forest on the bank opposite the fort. The sound of a clear, high voice and a monotonous sing-song now rang out behind him and came across the water with a distinctness that pierced and subdued all other sounds, even the beating of the ripples in his ears. Although no soldier, he had frequented camps enough to know the dread significance of that deliberate, drawling, aspirated chant. The lieutenant on shore was taking part in the morning's work. How coldly and pitilessly, with what an even calm intonation, presaging and enforcing tranquility in the men, with what accurately measured interval fell those cruel words. Company! Attention! Shoulder arms! Ready! Aim! Fire! Farquhar dived as deeply as he could. The water roared in his ears like the voice of Niagara, yet he heard the dull thunder of the volley and, rising again toward the surface, met shining bits of metal, singularly flattened, oscillating slowly downward. Some of them touched him on the face and hands, then fell away, continuing their descent. One lodged between his collar and neck. It was uncomfortably warm when he snatched it out. As he rose to the surface, gasping for breath, he saw that he had been a long time underwater. He was perceptibly farther downstream, nearer to safety. The soldiers had almost finished reloading. The metal ramrods flashed all at once in the sunshine as they were drawn from the barrels, turned in the air, and thrust into their sockets. The two sentinels fired again, independently and ineffectually. The hunted man saw all this over his shoulder. He was now swimming vigorously with the current. His brain was as energetic as his arms and legs. He thought with the rapidity of lightning.
The officer, he reasoned, will not make that martinet's error a second time. It is as easy to dodge a volley as a single shot. He's probably already given the command to fire at will. God help me. I cannot dodge them all. An appalling splash within 2 yards of him was followed by a loud rushing sound, diminuendo, which seemed to travel back through the air to the fort and died in an explosion which stirred the very rivers to its deeps. A rising sheet of water curved over him, fell down upon him, blinded him, strangled him. The cannon had taken a hand in the game. As he shook his head free from the commotion of the smitten water, he heard the deflected shot humming through the air ahead, and in an instant it was cracking and smashing the branches in the forest beyond. They will not do that again, he thought. The next time they will use a charge of grape. I must keep my eye upon the gun. The smoke will apprise me. The report arrives too late. It lags behind the missile. That is a good gun. Suddenly he felt himself whirled round and round, spinning like a top. The water, the banks, the forest, the now distant bridge, fort, and men were all commingled and blurred. Objects were represented by their colors only. Circular horizons, streaks of gold. That was all he saw. He had been caught in a vortex and was being whirled on with a velocity of advance and gyration that made him giddy and sick. In a few moments, he was flung upon the gravel at the foot of the left bank of the stream, the southern bank, and behind a projecting point which concealed him from his enemies. The sudden arrest of his motion, the abrasion of one of his hands on the gravel, restored him, and he wept with delight. He dug his fingers into the sand, threw it over himself in handfuls, and audibly blessed it. It looked like diamonds, rubies, emeralds. He could think of nothing beautiful which it did not resemble. The trees upon the bank were giant garden plants. He noted a definite order in their arrangement, inhaled the fragrance of their blooms. A strange roseate light shone through the spaces among their trunks, and the wind made their branches the music of aeolian harps. He had no wish to perfect his escape. He was content to remain in that enchanting spot until retaken. A whiz and a rattle of grape shot among the branches high above his head roused him from his dream. The baffled cannoneer had fired him a random farewell. He sprang to his feet, rushed up the sloping bank, and plunged into the forest. All that day he traveled, laying his course by the rounding sun. The forest seemed interminable. Nowhere did he discover a break in it, not even a woodsman's road. He had not known that he lived in so wild a region. There was something uncanny in the revelation. By nightfall he was fatigued, footsore, famished. The thought of his wife and children urged him on. At last he found a road which led him in what he knew to be the right direction. It was as wide and straight as a city street, yet it seemed untraveled. No fields bordered it, no dwelling anywhere. Not so much as the barking of a dog suggested a human habitation. The black bodies of the trees formed a straight wall on both sides, terminating on the horizon in a point like a diagram in a lesson in perspective. Overhead, as he looked up through this rift in the wood, shone great golden stars looking unfamiliar and grouped in strange constellations. He was sure they were arranged in some order which had a secret and malign significance. The wood on either side was full of singular noises, among which, once, twice, and again, he distinctly heard whispers in an unknown tongue. His neck was in pain, and lifting his hand, it found it horribly swollen. He knew that it had a circle of black where the rope had bruised it. His eyes felt congested. He could no longer close them. His tongue was swollen with thirst. He relieved its fever by thrusting it forward from between his teeth into the cold air. How softly the turf had carpeted the untraveled avenue. He could no longer feel the roadway beneath his feet. Doubtless, despite his suffering, he had fallen asleep while walking, for now he sees another scene. Perhaps he has merely recovered from a delirium. He stands at the gate of his own home. All is as he left it, and all bright and beautiful in the morning sunshine. He must have traveled the entire night. As he pushes open the gate and passes up the wide, white walk, he sees a flutter of female garments. His wife, looking fresh and cool and sweet, steps down from the veranda to meet him. At the bottom of the steps, she stands waiting, with a smile of ineffable joy, an attitude of matchless grace and dignity. Ah, how beautiful she is! He springs forwards with extended arms. As he is about to clasp her, he feels a stunning blow upon the back of the neck. A blinding white light blazes all about him with a sound like the shock of a cannon. Then all is darkness and silence. Peyton Farquhar was dead. His body, with a broken neck, swung gently from side to side beneath the timbers of the Owl Creek Bridge. Listening to Abundance, and right now I need to go to the phones and talk to Anonymous. Let me push the right button here and say there. How is Anonymous tonight?
Well, all right, thank you.
I apologize.
That was quite a surprising ending there to your story about
amazing?
The man who was hanged there.
Yeah, this is
on
actually
the bridge. Very surprising.
That's a story that a lot of high school students have to read. Probably good for them.
Very good. I was in a vortex like the hanged man.
Ooh.
A little bit. I experienced a fit of coughing because I choked on some meat the other day, 2 days ago in our dining room, and I excused myself and left out into the hall, and out rushes my next-door neighbor lady, who's about my age and has lost her husband through death recently, and she's very, shall we say, harassing of me, both in spoken word or in action. And
This doesn't sound good.
No, but it turns out fine. Yeah. And she grabbed me and pulled my sweater, and she said, "Let me help you." And I said, "I'm all right. When a person's coughing, you don't need to give them the Heimlich maneuver. And I'm all right. Please let me go." She said, "You fool, I'm trying to help you." I said, "You take your hands off me, please." Well, she didn't, and my sweater was pulled and stretched by her clutched hand, and I pushed her with a lot of force, and she freed from my sweater grip. Well, I heard her march down to the manager's desk and talk to the receptionist and say, he almost pushed me over. I thought, I'm in trouble now. And I didn't know how many witnesses were about. I went home and I thought, oh, brother, you're in for it now, because these women usually get the upper hand in a situation like that, right?
Yeah,
right.
I think you're right.
Yeah, so I said, "What are you going to do, buddy?" I said, "I'm going to call the police department and make a report to the desk sergeant." Well, the police were here within 15 minutes, and fortunately, and I do say in abundance, fortunately, I got two officers that heard my story, and they said, "Well, we're going to go to your next-door neighbor right down the hall and tell her to please back off from harassing you, as you've indicated." She wasn't there, so they went down to the dining room, surprised her at her table. I don't know what was said, but I feel that I was in a vortex, but I was completely relieved by the judgment of those two fine Salt Lake City police officers that came to my aid in 15 minutes. I didn't call 911. I called the desk sergeant, and I feel much relieved due to the good judgment of those two young officers.
Well, there you go. Prevention is the best. How's that saying go?
An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
There you go. Way to get it in order there. I appreciate your calling today. That sounds like a great bridge. I feel protected by them, too.
Okay.
Talk to you later.
Bye.
You've been listening to Abundance. This is Dane Allred. Every week at this time, we talk about 1,001 things I'm thankful for from my list of 1,001 thanks. These programs are available on daneallred.podbean.com. Or by clicking on daneallred.com, my website. That's DaneAllred com, or just type my name, Dane Allred, into a web browser. They're also available at 1001thanks.blogspot.com. They're available 24/7. And I want you to know how much I appreciate you listening today. Next week, The Plotter's Mile. We'll read some chapters from a new detective novel. Right here on Abundance.